In the aftermath of so many incidents of police violence and misconduct in the last few years, from Eric Garner to Freddie Gray and so many others, the Obama administration has responded to calls for justice by promising to reform policing itself. But our guest, Stuart Schrader, has written a piece in the latest issue of the Independent newspaper arguing that police reform won't solve the problems of police violence, as a long history of such reform efforts has shown. Stuart joins us now to discuss this piece. Good morning, Stuart. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Good morning.
So, Stuart, tell us, remind our listeners what exactly the Obama Police Task Force is. What is it supposed to do?
Right. Well, President Obama appointed the police task force that President's Task Force on 21st Century Policing is the official title. He appointed it in December of 2014. And as listeners will recall, December of last year was a time of massive nationwide protest against police abuse, police violence. And that protest has continued into this year. Mm-hmm. In December, the Obama administration's decision to appoint the task force followed right on the heels of the grand jury decisions in Missouri and in New York not to indict officers in the killings of Mike Brown and Eric Garner. So in the face of this widespread anger, sadness, and despair, the Obama administration had many tools for response, and among the most important was its decision to appoint this task force. So I think we should make no mistake, it's definitely the case that the appointment of the task force was a response to protest and to popular mobilization. Mm-hmm. And this sort of decision to appoint a task force to make an investigation is a familiar path for presidential administrations to take in response to crises, particularly crises around police violence. And the sort of precedent for these types of investigations was set by the Johnson administration in the 1960s, when a number of commissions and task forces were appointed, most famously the Kerner Commission in 1967, which released its report in 1968.
Mm-hmm. So I do want to get to the kind of history behind this as we move forward. But first, let's stay with the Obama task force for just a little while longer. So the task force was appointed last year. It's a blue ribbon commission. Who sits on it? Who are the people on the task force?
Well, the task force has, when it was appointed, it was given a budget of almost $1 million to conduct its inquiry. And its membership consisted of 11 members officially, but then, of course, there were many other staffers who worked with it. And they were drawn from the world of law enforcement expertise, the academy, and there were also some community organizers who were involved as well, including some from New York City. Hmm. And the task force held a series of hearings, which they called listening sessions, and they brought in witnesses to testify. And all of the testimony was made available to the public. It's all available online. It's easy to see what the task force heard and how they chose to take some of the recommendations from various expert witnesses that they got. And what they did was after their listening sessions and their teleconferences, they issued an interim report. The interim report then had feedback from members of the public and various constituencies. And then in May, the task force issued its final report.
Mm. And so what does that report say? What does the task force find at the conclusion of this long sort of series of back and forth between the public and members of the task force, the revisions of this? What's in that final report?
Well, as you might expect, because the task force was working closely with the Department of Justice, it does not offer a wholesale indictment of the criminal justice system. But it does get into many, many aspects of policing, and it tries to, I think, look forward rather than look back. But its main point, the main sort of what they call a pillar. There are six pillars, but the main pillar, the first pillar, is called building trust and legitimacy. And other pillars concern things like officer wellness, the technology that police use, police training. But in my piece in The Independent, I've tried to focus on this first pillar, which I think sort of underpins all the others, building trust and legitimacy. Mm. I focus on it and try to analyze why it is that the task force finds building trust and legitimacy to be so important and what they think the results or the consequences of that focus will be. And so to me, the most important sentences of the report, which are right at the very beginning, I'll read them to you, quote, "Decades of research and practice support the premise that people are more likely to obey the law when they believe that those who are enforcing it have authority that is perceived as legitimate by those subject to the authority. Mm. The public confers legitimacy only on those whom they believe are acting in procedurally just ways." So procedural justice is really a key concept for the task force, and it's central to their idea of police reform.
I'd like to ask you, Stuart, you talk about in your piece, we just stay with this task force for a moment. You said that the task force was not designed to lessen police violence or to reduce black people's encounters with police. Well, if it wasn't designed to do that, what was it designed to do then?
Well, I would say I have no doubt that the members of the task force and the witnesses who testified to the task force all do want to make sure there are fewer incidents like the killing of Mike Brown. But the way that they think it's possible to reduce these incidents is to change the way the public or citizens interact with police. Mm-hmm. It's a sort of multiple step way of thinking where they believe that if the police lack legitimacy in the eyes of the public with whom they're interacting, members of the public are less likely to respond to police in a compliant manner, to obey the sort of commands of police. And in their eyes, I think they see that lack of compliance as being the underlying cause for incidents like we had in Ferguson or in Staten Island.
So if you just did and followed the police officer's commands, whether it's Ferguson, wherever it is, then these things wouldn't happen. Is that their conclusion, more or less?
I think that's right. They're looking to build trust between the public and the police, but they feel that building this trust is something that can be done by making the police interact with the public in fair ways. In each individual interaction with the public, if it's fair, if it's polite, if the public feels like the members of the public feel like they're treated fairly, then that will ultimately lead to just outcomes. And
is this what's meant by procedural justice?
Exactly.
And can you explain what's
exactly
wrong with procedural justice in your view?
Well, procedural justice is a key idea for them, and it's been a key idea for people who have been working to reform the police for a very long time. Scholars have shown that this is throughout the 20th century has been a key concept, and what it means is that each individual interaction, each individual encounter should be fair and unbiased. And the way to do that is to remove individual biases among the police officers through rigorous training, raising educational standards. And the problem from the perspective of many of the people who were protesting in the streets over the past year is that they're calling for a broader systemic change, because they've been saying that the sort of susceptibility or vulnerability of people to police encounters is rooted in racial segregation, mm-hmm, economic inequality, and a wide array of broad structural issues that sort of come to a head in encounters with the police. The police task force that the Obama administration appointed rules out talking about all of these sort of underlying issues and tries to focus very, very narrowly on police encounters themselves. Mm-hmm. And so the key for them is trying to figure out how these individual encounters can be made just and fair, but they're sort of embedded in a much broader unfair system. And, and many folks who have been protesting feel that the police represent the sort of front lines of that unfair and unjust system. And one of my arguments in the article, what I say is that the task force is clear that the legitimacy of the badge is aimed at getting people to obey the law. Their key concern in terms of trust and legitimacy is really obedience and compliance in every encounter, because they feel that those encounters, when they're, you know, when they result in obedience, that will be, that will mean a lessening of the types of violence that we have seen that have led to the protests.
But of course, not addressing any of the kinds of structural violence that underpin, you know, how these incidents come to be. It sounds to me a little bit like a kind of technocratic version of you catch more flies with honey kind of thing, that if only the police were nicer and fairer in their treatment of the public, then there would be more compliance and there wouldn't be the kind of, I mean, ultimately, are what they're saying is that these incidents of violence spark from individuals' non-compliance, that it is the quote-unquote non-compliance of Michael Brown, of Eric Garner, that leads to their deaths. And that way, it seems to me that that seems to be blaming the victim of police violence in all of these cases.
I think that's right. I think that although the task force in all of its investigation is looking at the police, in a funny way, they're really sort of looking at the public and trying to figure out how to change how everyday people interact with the police. And whereas people protesting in the streets have been calling for a drastic reduction in the power of the police, what the task force is trying to do is actually figure out how to make the police more powerful and make their power more seamless. And ultimately, what we will see, or what we have already seen and what we will see going forward with the task force recommendations, is bolstering the amount of money that goes to police forces, which is really in direct contradiction to what protesters in the streets and in the op-ed pages have been calling for as a result of the incidents that we've seen over the past year.
So I do want to spend a little bit of time moving into some of the history of this as well. So you've talked about the way in which the task force very much sees the issue of legitimacy as central, and that making the police more legitimate actually serves to make them more powerful. And one of the ways that we know that, of course, is through the history of exactly these kinds of reform efforts that we've seen throughout the 20th century. So this isn't a new phenomenon, as you point out in your piece, right?
That's right. I think we could argue that the idea of reforming the police is an idea really as old as the institution of police itself, which goes back centuries. But in the 20th century, it's long been a liberal dream that fixing the problem of police abuse is within reach. It's just around the corner with the right sort of mixture of, as you said, technocratic reforms that are around the introduction of new sort of expert guidelines, new training regimens, new educational standards. And the idea that this will not only root out police abuse, but it will actually be the best way to solve the problems of criminality. And I think that in my research, what I've found is that the history of this really sort of comes into its own in the 1960s. There are earlier efforts dating back really throughout the 20th century with the collapse of the democratic machine politics in urban areas when police were really the sort of shock troops of a very sort of venal and corrupt political system. Once that sort of started to recede by the middle of the 20th century, there were new challenges that police faced, and the 1960s was really the key moment when a broad group of reformers was able to transform in many ways the relationship between various levels of policing within the United States and between the federal government, the states, and the municipalities. And that ushered in what we know as the War on Crime, which was really an effort to figure out how to reform police by introducing new standards, new training, new technologies, and ultimately to get federal funds in the hands of cash-strapped municipalities and other police forces. And that effort, of course, continues to this day. And the Obama administration's 21st century idea of police reform will, of course, also depend on getting money from federal coffers into police forces around the country so that they can buy new technologies, keep up to date with all of the latest gadgetry, as well as introduce new types of training and new standards.
Mm-hmm. So I want you to tell our listeners a little bit about some of these reforms of the 1960s, because I think people will be surprised to learn that some of the things that we really think of as some of the problems that we're facing with police today are actually the direct result of this earlier round of police reforms, right? So what were the what were some of these reforms introduced in the 1960s, as you described with the, I think you mentioned the Kerner Commission and other sorts of bodies?
Yeah, that's right. So the Kerner Commission, which was appointed in the aftermath of the civil violence in Newark and Detroit in the summer of 1967, it made a wide range of recommendations. Perhaps most famously, it really tried to get at the heart of some of the issues of racism and segregation and economic inequality. The Johnson administration, however, particularly President Johnson, didn't really want to hear much about those issues, sort of with the understanding that dealing with those issues was politically not viable, was far too expensive. On the other hand, the Kerner Commission did make some recommendations around, specifically around policing and police technologies. And those were adopted pretty much rapidly and seamlessly. And one of the most interesting technologies that came into being with the Kerner Commission that we might not really realize is as new as the 1960s is tear gas, specifically. The chemical weapon called CS. And there were other forms of tear gas that were in use prior to this. But in the 1960s, CS was a chemical that was used, tested experimentally widely in Southeast Asia, as well as other parts of the world. And what happened with the Kerner Commission was that some experts in counterinsurgency and riot control who were working around the globe testified before the Kerner Commission, and they recommended the use of chemical weapons. And their recommendation actually was they were looking quite closely at what was going on in the United States in the incidents of unrest from 1964 to 1967. And they said, look, the way that police have been dealing with these incidents,
which was shooting people, right? Which was
exactly.
Actually just using lethal force against protesters.
It was in their eyes, it was way too violent, using live ammunition, using bayonets, using batons. What it had done was discredit police. It had been too violent, and it had only led to further rounds of unrest.
Right.
So based on their experience of what they had witnessed overseas, they decided that the best way to go forward was to use less lethal forms of crowd control. And CS became the key mode of doing this. And what was really fascinating, as I found, was that the Kerner Commission recommendations were issued early in 1968. In April 1968, after Martin Luther King was assassinated, there was widespread unrest. Now, in 1967, in the unrest, there had been massive amounts of bullets fired in so-called crowd control. By 1968, less than a year later, after the Kerner Commission had issued its report, crowd control used a handful of bullets. Mm-hmm. Really, you know, thousands and thousands of soldiers and police. They used only a handful of bullets, but they now used thousands of CS grenades mm-hmm. in crowd control. And when you look at what the recommendations were saying, they were saying to be less lethal. And so CS seemed to fit the bill. Mm-hmm. In the past couple years, since Occupy Wall Street and in the Black Lives Matter protest, tear gas, other forms of chemical weapons have been used really widely, mm-hmm. and they've been a real focal point of outrage because they've seem to have been used with really indiscriminate
right.
and seemingly loose or no mm-hmm. guidelines whatsoever on their deployment.
Of course, we have the famous case of Officer Tony Baloney, right? The officer who was seen pepper spraying a kettled group of protesters during Occupy Wall Street, pepper spraying them at very close range. But the use of, as you're saying, the use of that kind of weapon to control protests, to control crowds, is actually the result of this earlier round of reform movements.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
Stuart, you talk about in your piece that let's focus on New York City police a little bit further. That the police department has diversified in a lot of ways over the past 50 years, yet you say the identity of individual officers does not change how patrols operate. I wonder if you would expound on that a little bit for our listeners.
Sure. One of the key recommendations, again, this is something that we find in the Obama administration's task force report, and it can be found in Johnson administration reports, that the idea that diversifying the police force, introducing more so-called minorities, introducing women into the force, that this is a way to increase the legitimacy of the police, to build trust between the public and the police. There is a really strong belief that this is a way to go forward that will improve the situation on the streets. And yet, what research has found by criminologists who have looked into this, there really is not very much evidence to show that it's true that increasing the diversity of police forces will lessen abuse or mm-hmm. will actually create better relations between members of the public and police. And I think that one of the key things we have to keep in mind is that police patrol decisions are oftentimes out of the hands of the officers who are, they're told what to do, and they do definitely have discretion on the streets, but if they're deployed to a neighborhood that is one of the poorer neighborhoods of New York City, which is, of course, where we see many of the police deployed, their encounters are sort of set up from the get-go by the deployment decisions, by the mm-hmm. administrative decisions about where, in the NYPD's terms, impact, where the impact should be.
Mm-hmm.
And that is out of the hands of the officers themselves.
And we saw this, of course, with the case of Akai Gurley killed last year in the Lewis Pink houses. in Brooklyn, where the decision to do these kinds of vertical patrols, as they're called, going up and down the stairwells of high-rise public housing, was, you know, the deployment was made with these kinds of rookie officers, people who are untrained or less trained, and who are taught, I think the more important point is that they are taught to really be in a situation of fear entering these places, right? And so it's there is some sense in which you can see the idea of better police training of, you know, people like if that officer had not been sort of taught by the culture of the NYPD, if he had not been sort of expecting to be in a situation of violence and fear, that he might not have had that same reaction. But you're saying that the statistics don't actually bear that out. The numbers of police killings in this country are just incredible. And, mm-hmm. you know, we've learned over the last few years that the federal government does not sort of centrally keep track of how many people are killed by law enforcement every year. But the various groups that have been trying to keep track of that, the numbers are just staggering, particularly when you compare it to other advanced industrial countries around the world where this just doesn't happen. So, Stuart, in our last few minutes, I wonder if you can just give us what you think the ultimate result of the task force recommendations will be.
Sure. I think that what you just said is exactly right, that police reform sort of has its own kind of alibi insofar as when it fails, the answer is just further reform, further introduction of new and better technologies and gadgets, new training standards, new educational standards, increasing the pay of police officers to make the job a more attractive type of job so that so-called better qualified mm-hmm. candidates can be brought onto the force.
Allowing them to move out of the city.
Exactly. And so what I think the results of the Obama administration's task force will be, and I think we're already seeing this, it will be the infusion of new funds from the Department of Justice to states and municipalities in order to bolster training by new technologies, especially so-called body-worn cameras or body cameras. This is something I talk about in my piece. There's a lot of money earmarked for this. And going forward, I think we're going to see a continual attempt to find these sort of technological fixes that are aimed at increasing legitimacy, which I don't think is going to lead to any sort of retrenchment of police power, mm-hmm. which is exactly what the protests have been calling for. Instead, it's going to mean an extension and a bolstering of police power on the streets.
A historical perspective here from our guest, Stuart Schrader, who is a postdoctoral fellow at the Charles Warren Center at Harvard University and author of the piece, The Liberal Solution to Police Violence, in the new issue of the Independent newspaper. You can find the article on their site, independent.org. Stuart, thanks so much for being with us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
It was a pleasure. And the Independent is one of our media partners here at WBAI, and the morning show in particular, along with the Jacobin magazine, City Limits, DNA Info, and other places. And Christy, as we approach the top of the hour, just want to pause for a moment and ask people to consider becoming that sustaining member to WBAI, a BAI buddy, if you will, someone that would make that ongoing contribution to the station. For as little as $10 a month, you can become that sustaining member.
It's really easy to do. You just go over to our website, WBAI.org, click on BAI Buddy, and set up that recurring donation. It costs so little every month to keep this listener-sponsored community radio station on the air. So please do support us. 7 o'clock here on the WBAI Morning Show. Head on over to our website, WBAI.org, click BAI Buddy to support us.